Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Gregory Stockel. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
With some foods, people can easily get confused about the correct names. For example, some might say yam when they actually mean a sweet potato. Is there any difference between shrimp and prawn? If a dish needs condensed milk, can you use evaporated milk instead? Well, one woman decided to answer these questions and many more in a new book called What's the Difference? Recreational Culinary Reference for the Curious and Confused. Writer Brett Warshaw recently spoke with the Associated Press. In her book, she explains the difference between jam and jelly, between broth and stock. She also explores how pie differs from tart. I feel like this hopefully can help fill in the gaps for people, Warshaw said. And even if they do know the difference, hopefully there's some other fun facts they can take away to make their knowledge more well-rounded. In one explanation, she describes the difference between Parmesan, a kind of dried cheese sold in the U.S., and Parmigiano Reggiano. Parmigiano Reggiano is a cheese that comes from a certain area in Italy and is prepared to meet specific standards. Parmesan, on the other hand, does not have such standards. In fact, it does not even have to be 100% cheese, Warshaw said. She added that all sorts of stuff could be passing as Parmigiano Reggiano, and it's definitely not the same thing. However, Warshaw says she is not criticizing the use of such a product. In fact, her boyfriend uses Parmesan on his pizza, and she still plans to marry him. The crime is not actually eating it, she said. If you want to eat it and you like it, no judgment there. She says she just wants people to use the right name. Sometimes Warshaw's research discovered no difference between commonly confused foods. For example, readers may be shocked to discover that button, criminy, and portobello mushrooms are all the same kind of mushroom. Or they may be surprised to find out that shrimp and prawns are completely different creatures, but they taste about the same. She said that is an interesting example. There is definitely a difference between shrimp and prawn, but in the end, she said, it doesn't really matter. However, do not confuse condensed milk with evaporated milk. They are not used in the same way. The book began in 2018. When Warshaw started researching the differences between all kinds of things. For example, she explored the differences between sea lions and seals. She also wondered whether balconies and terraces were the same. She said, "I had been debating with friends about the difference between a sweet potato and a yam, and realize I didn't know the difference." And she said she was kind of upset by that. Karen Rinaldi is Senior Vice President and Publisher at Harper Wave. As she worked on the book project, Rinaldi advised Warshaw to write only about confusing food terms. Rinaldi cooks all the time and still finds things confusing, like the differences between different types of beer, IPA, pale ale, and Pilsner. However, the description she most enjoys is about these baked goods, cobblers, crisps, and crumbles. The publisher added that the explanation helped her answer a question she had long asked. Many people have questions about a common cooking item, oil. Is there a difference between canola and corn oils? What about grapeseed, peanut, safflower, and vegetable oils? She found out that the kind of oil may not make much of a difference when cooking with it. Something that a lot of people maybe don't know is that any sort of neutral oil is pretty much fine for the same sort of purpose, she said. I'm Ana Mateo.
The coronavirus health crisis has caused problems for many families since taking hold last year. But some parents are thankful for one change. They are choosing to homeschool their children, even as schools plan to start in-person classes. There are many different reasons for this. The Associated Press spoke to several families. Some families have children with special educational needs. Others seek religion-based schooling or say their local schools have too many problems. They all have something in common. They tried homeschooling as a temporary measure and found that it helped their children. The U.S. Census Bureau reported in March that the percentage of households homeschooling their children rose to 11% by September 2020. That number was 5.4% just 6 months earlier. The increase was largest in Black households. Their homeschooling percentage rose from 3.3% in the spring of 2020 to 16.1% in the fall. Arlena and Robert Brown of Austin, Texas, have three school-age children. Then the pandemic took hold. After experimenting with online learning, they decided to try homeschooling. They taught a curriculum provided by Seton Home Study School that is based on Catholic religious teachings. The homeschooling service has 16,000 students in the United States. The Browns plan to continue homeschooling for the coming year. They are pleased that they can make the curriculum fit their children's needs. 11-year-old Jacoby has a condition that requires rest during the day. Riley is 10 and is considered gifted at school. And Felicity, aged 9, has a learning disability. Robert Brown is a former teacher who now advises businesses. He said he wants his children to do their best and have a solid understanding of their religion. Arlena Brown said the biggest difficulty was to unschool ourselves and understanding that homeschooling has so much freedom. She said, "We can go as quickly or slowly as we need to." Race played an important part in the decision of another Black family to homeschool their 12-year-old son, Dorian. Angela Valentine said Dorian was often the only Black student in his classes in public school in Chicago. He was sometimes treated unfairly by administrators and was hurt when other children stopped playing with him. As the pandemic eased, the family decided to homeschool Dorian. They are using a curriculum provided by National Black Home Educators that provides materials for each subject about African American history and culture. Valentine said, "Making the right choices was difficult." She added, "But until we're really comfortable with his learning environment, we'll stay on this homeschool journey." I'm Gregory Stockel.
A quake-measuring device on Mars is providing the first close look at the inside of the planet. The findings show a surprisingly thin crust and a hot, molten core beneath the Martian surface. Scientists recently reported that the Martian crust is about the same thickness as Earth's. The Martian mantle, the area between the crust and core, is about half as thick as Earth's. And the Martian core is bigger than what the scientists expected. However, it is still much smaller than Earth's core. These new studies confirm that the Martian core is molten. But scientists say more research is needed to know whether Mars has a solid inner core like Earth's, surrounded by a molten outer core. Stronger Mars quakes could help identify any multiple core layers, the scientists said. The findings are based on about 35 Mars quakes recorded by a French seismometer on the American Space Agency NASA's InSight spacecraft. A seismometer is a device that responds to ground noises and shaking. InSight arrived on Mars in 2018. The seismometer on InSight has detected 733 Mars quakes so far. But the 35 with magnitudes from 3.0 to 4.0 served as the basis for these studies. Most of the sizable quakes came from a volcanic area 1,600 kilometers away where lava may have flowed millions of years ago. Mark Panning is with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and took part in the crust study. He said, "Even the biggest Mars quakes are so weak they would barely be felt on Earth." He is hoping for a bigger quake, which would make it easier to process the information and describe the inside of Mars. Current measurements show Mars's crust possibly reaching as deep as 20 kilometers to 37 kilometers. The mantle extends down nearly 1,600 kilometers. And the relatively lightweight core has a radius of 1,830 kilometers. Earth's crust ranges from a few kilometers beneath the oceans to more than 70 kilometers beneath the Himalayan mountains in Asia. Earth is almost double the size of Mars. Panning said, By going from cartoon understanding of what the inside of Mars looks like, putting real numbers on it, we are able to really expand the family tree of understanding how our solar system's rocky planet formed. The InSight mission has been extended by another 2 years. But in recent months, InSight has had power issues. Dust covered its solar panels just as Mars was approaching the farthest point in its orbit around the Sun. Solar panels are large, flat pieces of equipment that use the sun's light or heat to create electricity. Flight controllers have increased power by using the spacecraft's robotic arm to release sand into the wind to remove some of the dust on the panels. The seismometer has continued working, but all other science instruments have been temporarily stopped because of the power issues. A German heat-seeking device, however, was declared dead in January after it failed to dig more than half a meter into the planet.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
On July 4, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, approved the Declaration of Independence. The new country, the United States of America, was at war with its former colonial ruler, Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision to declare independence. No one knows for sure how many Americans remained loyal to Great Britain. John Adams, the Massachusetts political leader, thought that about a third of the colonists supported independence, a third supported Britain, and a third supported neither side. Today, many historians think that only about 20% of the colonists supported Britain. Some colonists supported whichever side seemed to be winning. As many as 30,000 Americans fought for the British during the war. Others helped Britain by reporting the movements of American troops. Who supported Britain? These groups included people who were appointed to their jobs by the king. They also included leaders of the Anglican Church and people with business connections to the British. Professor Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says many colonists from minority groups remained loyal to the king.
One of the problems of the American Revolution that emerged very quickly was the tyranny of the majority, which the founders, the revolutionary leaders, had not anticipated. But I think we're seeing the problems that emerge when you overthrow an authoritarian leader and you're going to have a relatively democratic society, then protecting the minority becomes a problem.
Other people remained loyal because they did not want change or because they believed that independence would not improve their lives. Some thought the actions of the British government were not bad enough to bring about a rebellion. Others did not believe that the rebels could win a war against a nation as powerful as Britain. American Indians disagreed among themselves about the revolution. Congress knew it had to make peace with the Indians as soon as the war started, If not, American troops might have to fight them and the British at the same time. To prevent trouble, American officials tried to stop settlers from moving into Indian lands. In some places, the Indians joined the Americans, but generally they supported the British. They expected the British to win. They saw the war as a chance to force the Americans to leave their lands. At times, the Indians fought on the side of the British, but left when the British seemed to be losing the battle. The Americans did not forget that the Indians chose to fight for the British. When the war was over, the Americans felt they owed the Indians nothing. African slaves in the colonies were also divided about which side to join during the American Revolution. Thousands of slaves fought for the British. The British offered them freedom if they served in the army or navy. Some American states also offered to free slaves who served, and hundreds of free blacks fought on the American side. Many slaves, however, felt their chances for freedom were better with the British. At least 5,000 blacks served with the colonial American forces. Most had no choice. They were slaves, and their owners took them to war or sent them instead of the owner's sons. Other slaves felt that a nation built on freedom might share some of that freedom with them. In the South, many slave owners kept their slaves at home rather than send them to fight. Later in the war, when every man was needed, many slaves drove wagons and carried supplies. Those who served in the colonial army and navy were not separated from whites. They fought side by side with whites during the American Revolution. But historians say most slaves spent the war as they always had, working on their owners' farms. The American rebels called themselves patriots. Those who supported the British were known as Tories. Patriots often seized the property of Tories to help pay for the war. They also kidnapped the slaves of Tories to use as laborers for the army. Many Tories were forced from towns in which they had lived all their lives. Some were tortured or hanged. In New Jersey, Tories and Patriots fought one another with guns and sometimes burned each other's houses and farms. Some historians say the American Revolution was really the nation's first civil war. The Revolution divided many families. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society tells of a woman named Phoebe. Phoebe was married to a patriot, but her brother was a Tory.
And we think about what it must have been like for Phoebe in the middle between her husband and her brother. So that's a perfect example of a family that was split.
The Patriots were also split among themselves in their thinking. The colonies did not really think of themselves as one nation. They saw themselves as independent states trying to work together toward a common goal. Historian Gordon Wood says, at first, the United States was more like the European Union is today.
When Jefferson said, "My country," he meant Virginia. John Adams said, "My country," meant Massachusetts.
This meant that Congress could not order the states to do anything they did not want to do.
Congress could not demand that the states provide money for the war. It could only ask for their help. George Washington, the top general, could not draft men into the army. He could only wait for the states to send them. Washington showed that he was a good politician by the way he kept Congress and the 13 states supporting him throughout the war. Just as Americans did not all agree about the war, the British people did not agree about it either. Many supported the government's decision to fight. They believed that the war was necessary to rescue loyalists from the Patriots. Others did not think Britain should fight the Americans because the Americans had not invaded or threatened their country. They believed that Britain should leave the colonies alone to do as they wished. King George was not able to do this, however. He supported the war as a way to continue his power in the world and to rescue British honor in the eyes of other national leaders. Whichever side British citizens were on, there was no question that the war was causing severe problems in Britain. British businessmen could no longer trade with the American colonies. Prices increased. Taxes did too. And young men were forced to serve in the Royal Navy. At the start of the war, the British believed that the rebellion was led by a few extremists in New England. They thought the other colonies would surrender if that area could be surrounded and controlled. So they planned to separate New England from the other colonies by taking control of the Hudson River Valley. The British changed their plans after they were defeated in the Battle of Saratoga in New York State. Historian Gordon Wood says the British loss changed the nature of the war.
The French feel at this point that the Americans might make it, and therefore they throw in their support. Once the French come on board, then the British are really panicked. At that point, they offer the Americans everything the Americans had wanted, save independence. But it was too late.
The British experienced many problems fighting the war. Their troops were far from home across a wide ocean. It was difficult to bring in more troops and supplies. Gordon Wood says the distance across the Atlantic was one reason the British lost the war.
Even though they were the most powerful nation in the world, had a superb army, and of course completely controlled the seas, and they were dealing with the ragtag army of George Washington and a bunch of militia, and they couldn't do it.
General Washington's army had its own problems, too. Congress never had enough money. States often did not do what they were supposed to do. And citizens were not always willing to fight. Soldiers were poorly trained and would promise to serve for only a year or so.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.